This is episode 40 of Social Entrepreneur with Chris Atageka of Rides for Lives.
You gotta find your passion. And once you find your passion, because once you are a social entrepreneur, you definitely have something you are very passionate about, then you gotta figure out how you get paid.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 40 of Social Entrepreneur with Chris Atageka of Rides for Lives. Social entrepreneurship can come in a lot of different forms from a lot of different places. And sometimes we hear stories about people who live a life of privilege and they have an abundance of resources and they are able to give those resources and to put them into action to make a big impact and change the world. Well, Chris Atageka's story doesn't exactly start out like that. In fact, his parents both died from HIV/AIDS when he was 7 years old, and he became the head of the household. He was responsible for taking care of his four younger brothers and sisters. And then one of his brothers died because they could not get his brother to a hospital in time. Chris eventually made his way to an orphanage, and there he was sponsored by a couple in the United States who gave him enough money so that he could go to high school. And he went through high school, and he was a very good student, and he corresponded with his sponsors. And eventually, his sponsors did something really generous. They offered to let Chris come live with them in California and to attend Berkeley. So Chris took advantage of this opportunity. He went to Berkeley, he studied engineering, and the whole time he was there, he kept thinking about this problem with healthcare back in his native Uganda. And eventually he launched the company Rides for Lives. Now, I'm going to let Chris tell that story, but one point I wanted to make here is we also spend a little bit of extra time during this interview because Chris was an Echoing Green Fellow. And so we took the opportunity for Chris to tell the story about what it's like to be an Echoing Green Fellow and what he got out of that. And it's a really great story. Here he is, Chris Atageka of Rides for Lives.
My name is Chris Atageka. I am the founder and CEO of Rides for Lives. And Rides for Lives basically is a nonprofit organization that builds innovative vehicles that bring healthcare access to folks in hard-to-reach areas in East Africa.
In East Africa, okay. And Chris, what's your story, or what was it that caused you to be interested in transportation related to healthcare in East Africa?
So healthcare in East Africa is just one of the many parts of the world that, you have majority of people living on less than $1 a day. The reason I'm passionate about healthcare, it's my own upbringing and my own personal tragedies that drove me towards doing this. So I can share one of the examples of the stories that have happened to me to kind of get me to do the work that I do. So both my parents passed away due to HIV when I was a little boy. And at that time, I really did not know, what to do, because I was just one of the many people facing kind of becoming victims of lack of access to healthcare. But then, fast forward when I became an engineer, I came to America, became an engineer, have a technical skill. My experiences of growing up and my technical background combined, I figured there's no better way to put it other than kind of try to bring healthcare access to folks in rural areas so that they don't have to suffer the same fate my parents suffered. Because HIV is something that you can live to be 100 so long as you have access to a pill you can take every day and life moves on normally. So that's where my passion came from.
Mm. How old were you when your parents passed away?
I was about 7, and it was about 5 of us, my 4 younger siblings. And when my parents passed away, it was my responsibility to take care of my younger siblings because I was the older child. And I was not special in any way. It's just that it's a very, very common problem in most developing countries when a family member passes on. They have a bunch of kids, and then the relatives who have many of their own kids do not have the capacity to take on the kids of the deceased person. Then the kids have to take care of themselves. So child-headed families is a common thing in Africa.
Yeah. So you were 7 years old. You're taking care of your siblings. How did you end up in the U.S. in an engineering degree?
Oh man, it's a very long story. But the short version of it, it's all miracle and luck. There's nothing short of that. I was in the village, and an individual told me about an orphanage, which is about 40 kilometers from my village, and said. And of course, this individual knew about my desire for education, but really never had the opportunity. And they told me there's an orphanage that's helping orphans go to school. And basically, this orphanage, what they do, it's kind of matchmaking between sponsors and students. So I had a sponsor in America matched to me through this orphanage. And they were paying $25 each month, and I started going to school. Went to school for about 7 years, and this family, you know, I did well in school as well. And this family offered the opportunity for me to come and go to school in America after I finished my high school. And that is not something that comes around every day for everybody. And it was just for me. I was lucky in the right place at the right time, and they brought me over, and that's how I ended up at engineering school. Mm.
So you came to the U.S. You're going to engineering school. At what point did you come up with this business plan? Were you in a particular class, or how did you end up going from student to social entrepreneur?
It's definitely crawl before you walk and walk before you run type of thing. I did a school project where I manufactured a tiny engine, a tiny combustion engine that I, you know, used off the shelf parts to put together. I was a mechanical engineer. That information may be important. All I wanted to do is basically motorize bicycles, because the number two commonly used mode of transportation after walking is a bicycle. And most people in Africa use bicycles, but bicycles require a lot of manpower to actually ride around. So I was like, okay, so there's a bicycle, there's a motorcycle. How can I create something in between? So it created a little engine, attached it on the bicycle, and it worked well. And they started testing that out there, trying to figure out cost points, conditions, how can it work, and it with the roads. And it turned out it was a terrible idea. You know, it was very expensive. Also, the chains were not adapted to that environment because we have a lot of poor roads and potholes. And every time the potholes are, the bicycle is going through potholes, the drivetrain and the gears eat up the chain, and the chain ends up falling off. And I learned a few lessons through that. But in the process, I kept innovating around that. And I ended up building close to 12 products. And that's how I ended up on working with ambulances and mobile hospitals. But it all started with this small bicycle.
So you were field testing in Eastern Africa?
That's correct. Uganda, yeah. To be exact.
In Uganda. When you built your first bicycle, was it your thought, I want to improve transportation? Or was it your thought, I want to improve access to healthcare? Or were both in your mind at the time?
They were both in my mind, but at the same time, like, there's so many things that need to be in place to be able to end up at saying, oh, I wanted to improve the education field. I wanted to improve the, mass incarceration. I wanted to improve healthcare. Like, there's a lot of things you have to work on before that thought is very clear. So I started off with transportation, and the whole idea is be able to use a bicycle in a faster way to get to the hospital. And also, like, the other piece of information that may be important here is my brother, my little brother, passed away because he could not make it to the hospital fast enough. So, things like that were definitely in my subconscious, trying to figure out, how do I make transportation faster, accessible, and healthcare. But at the same time, it was all very foggy. How are you going to do that? And it's through iterations and designs and testing that it all became apparent and clear down the road after working on a few products.
And so you started off with this bicycle, but the bicycle kept eating the chain. And so you started making more hardened kinds of vehicles made for the kinds of conditions in Uganda. So what kind of vehicles did you create?
So we started off with bicycles, and the whole idea was like, oh man, bicycles are made in India and China, and there's no single country in Africa that makes bikes. Why is that so? Why can't we make them here? Like, asking myself these fundamental questions. So I started making actual bikes, and then I realized, like, man, cost, terrible idea. China has figured it out. It's so expensive for me to make a bicycle in Uganda than it is to buy one that comes from China. And then they kind of moved on from that, and they started building wheelchairs. So I built tricycles for persons with disabilities. It's all about improving transportation, but help them kind of be mobile, independent, give them dignity, and be able to transport themselves to hospitals and things like that. So we moved on to what we call the village ambulance. So this is a bicycle ambulance or motorcycle ambulance, and it's made for the roads that are narrow, that are kind of dirt-like and that cannot be accessed by regular vehicles. So this is like a cart that's being dragged by a bicycle or motorcycle. It's a large cart. It's a large cart that can fit, a 7-foot person, and it carries up to 400 pounds. And basically, it's an emergency system where you call in and someone picks you up when you're a pregnant mother, you want to go to the hospital, or you break your arm and you need someone to drop you off. So, the piece of information that's important for the audience to know here is that a 911 call equivalent in most developing countries does not exist. So when you have an emergency, it can be life or death. It's not as easy to get someone to get you to the hospital. So that is the system we're trying to create. But then from there, I realized And I built thousands of those products. We dropped off people to the hospitals and realized that dropping off people to the hospitals is not enough, because they spend hours and sometimes days to see doctors because doctors are not readily available. And then they started thinking deeper and harder, like, how can I create a comprehensive solution that will solve this problem? And that's when I started building mobile hospitals. And mobile hospitals are giant buses that we transform into a doctor's room, a lab, and a pharmacy. So someone can receive all kinds of care you can expect to receive at a hospital, of course, with limitations, within this unit. You can see a doctor, you can get your blood drawn and you get results. You can, they do HIV screenings, malaria screenings, cancer screenings, and cryotherapy for cervical cancer. So we do a lot within this one unit. And we have, you know, we get to see 150 to 200 people every single day per unit. So it's a high impact product.
So your physicians are able to see between 150 and 200 people per day per unit?
Yep, and we ran out of time and supplies before we could see all the people in line who have been lining up all day to get the service.
Wow. And so how does that work? I mean, first of all, who employs the physicians and the other health professionals?
So the unit is in the model we use is called micro-entrepreneurship. So basically, so just to take you back or kind of give you a sense of the healthcare system, there's public hospitals and very limited doctors, but they're there and they're supposed to be paid by the government to be there 24/7. And what happens is, because there's very limited doctors, so high demand, but also very limited supervision and very underpaid, doctors end up starting their own private clinics. And they spend like 85% of their time at their private clinics getting paid cash. So anyone who can afford to pay cash can go to a private doctor. And then the poor folks, who are like the majority, over 86%, are the ones sitting at the hospital floor waiting for this doctor to show up. Yet the hospital pays them, or the government pays them, to supposedly be there. But it all goes back to the incentives. So what I do is I create something that's better than their private clinic, and then they're incentivized to be there. They charge for some services and subsidize on the other services, and they are able to make money using the units, and that's how they are incentivized to be there.
And how many of these mobile units do you have?
So we started off with one last year. We're building another one this year, but most of the products have been primarily the village ambulances. So this is new to us as well.
So when the doctor goes to the village, you know, you were talking about people who live on $1 or $2 per day.
Mm-hmm.
There can't be a lot of money then for the doctor to make in a village like that. Is that?
Oh, there is money. So let me explain it. So these people, when you have a health emergency, it doesn't matter what you have in your house. It doesn't matter if you have land. It doesn't matter if you have a goat. It doesn't matter if you have a cow. You will sell anything to get to the hospital. That's kind of like the bottom line. So patients who, let's say you have an emergency and you need to see a doctor, will sell their goat. And if they sell their goat, their first, you know, 50% of that price will go towards transportation to get themselves to the nearest hospital, which is normally some distance far away. And then the remainder is 50% of that money. I'm just giving an example. Those numbers are just for example purposes. And then they're remaining with a certain percentage of that money, and that's what they have available to give to the doctor. But when the mobile unit is at the village level, they have all that money, 100%, and they have it available to spend towards the health problem.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense.
So living on less than a dollar is like personal budgeting. Mm-hmm. But if an emergency happens, you know, land will go, a cow will go, a goat will go, a house will go until someone is okay.
So the person who needs the physician, they're going to end up paying for this anyway. But the government, from what I understood, supposedly the government is providing free health care for all, but the physicians themselves aren't actually staffing the free health care clinics. Is that
And they have no medicine either.
There's no drugs, there's no doctors.
So you go there and you lie on the floor for days before you could see one doctor. Even if you had a chance to see a doctor, so for few people who have the opportunity to bribe the gatekeepers to be able to see the doctor, they can do that. And when they see the doctor, then the doctor will write them a prescription. Then they have to leave the hospital, go to a private clinic somewhere to buy the medicine. And if you get admitted, then you are sleeping on a hospital bed by buying medicine from outside. So it's a very, very broken system.
Mm. Yeah, it does. It sounds like there are so many components that are broken, and you're just trying to fix as many of those as you can.
As possible as you can. And again, it's not perfect yet. I'm still also figuring out the most people we can possibly reach in the most sustainable way possible.
Right. So your solutions so far have been, you know, you made some trikes, you made a cart that will allow people to be transported to a clinic, and now you're making these mobile clinics that are going out. Are you and your team, do you employ people who build these mobile clinics?
Yes, that's what we do, yes.
Okay, so you're creating jobs then also for people who are building these mobile clinics?
Yes, absolutely. And that's key. The whole idea is there are so many people with good intentions that build solutions from a Western world and they drop it off in some developing country. And when, as soon as they leave, one single bolt falling out of an entire $1 million project equals the project's not functional. And the local people don't know how to fix it. So for me, as an individual growing up in those regions and also seeing these, you know, things day in, day out, where someone builds a well, good-intended product and the heart is in a good place and they leave like a well somewhere with people getting water, and as soon as they leave 2 weeks later, the well is not functional and there goes the money. So my whole idea is, you know, create it in a way that the local people know how to make it, the local people know how to maintain it, and in the process, you're creating jobs, you're supporting the local economy, and then the project is more sustainable that way on a technical standpoint.
And are you building these from the ground up, or is there sort of an OEM model where you're sourcing some engines or you're sourcing some, you know, how is that being done there?
So there are places where you can buy spare parts for different. We're using vehicles that are fully adapted into the environment. So instead of going to the, you know, lot somewhere and buying a bus, what we do, we go to the spare parts for this bus and we buy the chassis, the body, and we put it together and put the engine together, do the wiring and have it running. And the whole key is that there are so many parts we don't need if we bought a full bus. You know, we don't need the entire 80 seats inside the bus, and that's the cost that we cut out. So we just put things together and we build them customized to our needs.
Mm. And when it comes to the physicians or the, let's say, nurses or other health professionals those are all people who are just that they are acquiring your vehicle and then using them, but you're not training them in any way. That's not part of your business model, right?
No, it's not. But as you can imagine, there's so many pieces. If you decided to split yourself, you end up doing nothing. there's so many pieces to the puzzle. But for us, we do a really good job on vetting these people to make sure that we find a doctor and the nurses that are within one unit or within one facility that already running a ground business and they know how to manage a business. So we're not training them on the business side of things. We're just kind of supporting them to say, hey, you can make more money and you can reach more people and help people at the bottom of the pyramid kind of mindset.
Okay. And so the you mentioned earlier the cart that transports people. And you said, you know, there's no equivalent to dialing the emergency number in Western worlds. For that particular product, are you and your team, are you building the product or are you, I assume you are building the product, but in addition to that, are you doing any of the coordination of, you know, somebody calling somebody and coming and getting a cart and taking them away?
So we build the product. That's step one. Step two is we do get to the people in two major ways. The first one is through partners. We've worked with people like in the past, like Red Cross, UNICEF, Save the Children, Plan International, Samaritan Purse, and all these are like global NGOs that have networks and systems in place already to reach people at the bottom of the pyramid. So that's our first mechanism of getting the product out there. The second mechanism is when we actually do the delivery ourselves. And every village you go to in Africa has what they call the village chief or the village local person or chairwoman or chairman. And this person is the trusted individual in this village and is the go-to person when there's any problem. It doesn't have to be healthcare, but any problem in general. So that's the person we go targeting and looking for. And he's the person who helps us locate a trusted individual who will be the ambulance rider in the town and who's reliable, who is going to be available when people need him. And these people really love to take this job. And the reason they do is because they become like a local hero in a way. Such that if, let's say, your wife wanted to give birth and you called some guy and he was available, he dropped her off, she gives birth to a baby, and he picks that your wife and your baby up and bring them back home, that guy's never going to buy a beer at a bar anymore. So because of that, these village riders are very it's a prestigious job that everyone wants to take.
Somewhere along the way, you ended up as a fellow at Echoing Green. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. How did you end up in Echoing Green and what did you gain from that?
So Echoing Green is one of those fellowships that deeply and mean it care about social entrepreneurs. And when they say they care about you, they deeply mean that they do. There's so many fellowship programs. I'm part of many fellowship programs. I'm a Shoka Fellow. I'm Forbes 30 Under 30 Social Entrepreneurs in the World. There's a Harambe Fellow. I'm a Gifted Citizen Fellow. There's so many fellowships out there. But I can tell you one thing about Echoing Green. When they say they care about you, they mean it. And the reason is that there's so many talk out there saying, oh, we are blah, blah. We help and support early stage entrepreneurs. We support, you know, young entrepreneurs and we really care about people. But, you know, the ideas are great, but people are important. And when the idea doesn't pan out, they drop you. But Echoing Green is you and you only. If they believe in you, if they trust you, they will support you regardless of whether the idea you proposed works or doesn't. If it doesn't work and you start something else, they will still support you. You are a fellow and you will always be a fellow. And that's, my friend, very, very important when you're like early stage and trying to figure things out.
Hmm. That's great insight. I appreciate that. How did you end up in the Echoing Green program?
You know, I applied. Somebody told me about it. I applied and I didn't get it the first time. I applied again and I got in. So it's all about application and knowing that it exists. So once you know that it exists, you know, work hard and put together an application and end up, if you are lucky, you get invited to a final interview, which they fly you out into New York and you meet in person. And if you get a fellowship, then you're a fellow for 2 years. But applying is very competitive. They get close to 4,000 applicants for like 50 to 80 slots. So it's a very, very competitive process. But there are some people who have famously applied 5-6 times before they got in. So if you don't get in the first time, it doesn't mean your idea is terrible. It doesn't mean you're stupid or your idea is not good. It's just that the competition is so steep that you have to continue being persistent until you get in. In fact, there's someone who actually works there who says, I got rejected 3 times and never got in here. I was like, I got to get a job there instead. and he famously says that. So, yeah.
Right. So, Chris, describe the fellowship process or, you know, you applied, you were accepted. So what happens when you are an Echoing Green Fellow?
So once you're an Echoing Green Fellow, so if you apply as a partner, if you have a partner and you're a 2-person team, you get $90,000. If you're a 1-person team, you get $80,000. And they give it to you on a quarterly basis. And the beauty about it, about this money, is that they know you're early stage. They know you're going to figure things out. They know you have to kind of like take risks in some places. So their model and their mantra is you get the money and they give you the leeway to trust you enough that whatever you decide that this money is meant to do is the right thing. You could choose to pay yourself a salary. You could choose to build more products. You could choose to do marketing. Whatever you decide, they're not going to ask you where, how, why, all those questions, and budgeting and all that stuff. They will, you know, of course, for accountability purposes, they will ask later. But it's all on you to be able to use the money the right way so that you move your company, yourself, growth, and development forward. So money is one part. The second part is, and they give it to you on a quarterly basis, which is key because, you know, 4 months later you ran out of money, you know a check is coming. So it's very, very good money for a starting out social entrepreneur. And then the second part of it is the community. And I think a community is one of the key elements to it. Echoing Green is connected to pretty much anybody anywhere on this planet. So many famous people have actually been Echoing Green Fellows, including Michelle Obama, somebody you probably have heard of. There's so many people that care about that community. And if you need any introduction to somebody, you just contact them and say, hey, I have this reason. I want to contact blah, blah. And they will make that introduction happen. And if they don't know, they will find someone in their network that can make it happen. And that's really good for an entrepreneur to have a reliable network of people like-minded and care about you and what you're doing and want to help you succeed. And then the last part that I think is very important for early stage entrepreneurs is therapy. They have chaplains, people you get to call and just talk whatever you want to say. They are there to listen. They are there. They are not there to solve your problem, but they are there to listen to you and talk to you in times when things are not going well or when things are going well. And every, you know, 2 weeks or so, you get an email saying, hey, I'm blah, blah. I'm just checking in with you. How are you doing? You no need to reply, but if you feel like you need to talk, let's talk. And something as simple as that for a social entrepreneur, it's very, very key. This is a very lonely world that sometimes things you can't tell your mother or your spouse or whatever. And now you have someone who's going to listen. They're not going to judge you, but understand what you're going through. But anyways, I feel like I'm rambling too much.
No, you're doing great. And you said chaplain. Is there a spiritual element to it, or is it more like mentor, as in just someone who is overseeing and helping and supporting you?
It's more like a therapist, okay. So to speak. Yeah. Someone who will support, listen, talk to you, try to brainstorm with you. When things are not going okay, particularly. And if they're going okay, they are very happy to chat and have a conversation. So you kind of have this friend, that's available to you at all times. And that's a very good park to have for any social entrepreneur or any entrepreneur in particular who don't have mentors. Even some mentors, you can't tell them some other things. And these are people you can just ramble off on anything and everything, and they're there to listen. So,
right.
Yeah.
And I could see how that would work, because I've been a mentor in incubator kind of programs, and there's a drive, a need on the part of the social entrepreneur to want to please me as a mentor. They want to say all the things, I'm asking.
You want to hear.
Right. I'm asking them hard questions, how will this be profitable, and what testing have you done in the marketplace, and how
then
do you know
that?
Then
they become defensive.
Right. And they want to please me. So they, I'm asking hard questions to make their business better, but you need somebody that you could talk to that has no vested interest whatsoever in your business success, other than they care about you. And so it's a different role, isn't it?
It is definitely a different role. And like you said, mentors are there, and when you get matched to a mentor for some reason, because they have something to offer in your field, or they're like on top of their field, they understand what you're doing, and they can help you navigate this space and all that. But when you're having a 1-hour meeting with your mentor, you want to make the best out of it. But most of the time, entrepreneurs, and what I've learned in the process or listening and mentoring other entrepreneurs too, they try to be on the positive side all the time. They're not going to come in and say, this is just messed up. It's not working. I just need to, figure out, can you give me some pointers? Very, very few people who are going to say that, because they don't want to come off as if they are failing. And with this kind of service, you can go there and say, I may shut doors tomorrow. things are not working. And yeah. Then this person will be like, okay, so let's get to the bottom of this. So right. That's a very good service.
That's great. Were you co-located with other fellows during the Echoing Green Fellowship?
What does that mean to be co-located?
So did you go somewhere and reside there during your time as a fellow, or are the fellows just scattered to the winds and they live where they live and you aren't necessarily together?
Oh, so that's the other part I forgot to mention is once you become a new fellow, there's a new fellow retreat. You spend an entire week at some place, going through brain trusts. These are like organized groups that sit down and try to solve your one specific problem. You just tell them, I'm doing this thing, I want to figure out my business model, I don't know what it is, I need people to help me. So they put together a team of people in a room, and they try to kind of like pound on it and try to figure out what your business model is. So the whole week has multiple activities, and that brain trust is just one of them. And people get to know each other. People get to know who is in their class. There's partying, there's food, there's work. And that whole week is the first initiation. And then every year there is what they call All Fellows Retreat. And it happens towards the end of the year. And I just came back from one in South Africa. Last year we were in India. And the whole point is the reason they hold them in different locations around the world is to try to give people a perspective of how the rest of the world lives or looks like. And that's also another really added part that so not so many people get the opportunity to see. But also the All Fellows Retreat is meant to bring fellows who are new to the fellows who have been around in the past. And again, spend a whole week in some location and do all these activities, get to know each other, connect and bond and form networks. And they do that every year.
Well, we've been talking a lot about Echoing Green, so let's think for a second then about advice for people who are considering this path of being a social entrepreneur. What's one great piece of advice? Maybe some piece of advice that you've received yourself that was really helpful along the way, or one piece of advice you would have for other people as they consider their journey to being a social entrepreneur?
I think I've learned along the way. You got to find your passion. And once you find your passion, because once you're a social entrepreneur, you definitely have something you are very passionate about, then you got to figure out how you get paid. And you have to figure out how to get paid on a market rate. You cannot drive on passion forever. It dries out. It gets to a certain point where you get to burn out. So what I mean by this is so many social entrepreneurs end up sacrificing their life, their heart, their soul, their resources, trying to help the other person. You know, because people like us who are social entrepreneurs, we are what they call the bleeding hearts, uh-huh. whereby you can, you know, get to your bank account, take every penny out and try to help the other person. You take a shirt off your body to give it to the other person. You know, we are that into the work that we do and we're passionate about it. But then when it comes down to it, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, if you are not paying yourself sufficiently, you're not paying your bills, you don't have a roof on your head, you get to a certain point and you will burn out. So find your passion, figure out how you get paid sufficiently, and then you never have to work a day in your life because you really care about what you do, and every day is not work. It's just having fun.
If people were looking for Rides for Lives on the web or on social media, where would they find you?
So it's we have a website. It's called ridesforlives.org. And then I have social media. It's all at Chris Ategeka on Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn, Christopher Ategeka, and Facebook as well. We have ridesforlives.org. So
I'll put links to all this in the show notes. So when people listen to the podcast, they'll be able to go to the show notes and click through for the for your Twitter account, your LinkedIn, and et cetera. I'm going to ask you to give a call to action to the listeners of the podcast here in one moment. But before I do, Chris, let me just take a second to acknowledge you. I often hear social entrepreneurs say, "I was just lucky," or "it was serendipity," right? But you also had to put yourself in a position to receive that luck and to receive that serendipity. You had to go 40 kilometers away to this orphanage where you could get connected and you could get help. And you raised your siblings and you did all these things. And, you know, you went to the field and tested your ideas. You could have come to the United States, gotten your mechanical engineering degree, and then gone to work for General Electric and built, you know, airplane turbines or something, you know. But instead, you chose to go back and to give back. And so I just want to acknowledge you And your role in the luck and the serendipity and all that, and acknowledge the good that you're doing in the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's one of those things that, you know, like, if I'm not doing this, what else can I be doing kind of question. You know, I had those opportunities. I have 2 degrees, advanced degrees from Berkeley. And, you know, I've had opportunities and job offers from all these fancy giant companies that are ruling the world. But I had to turn it down because this meant more for me as an individual. And that's kind of rolls into your question that you you wanted to ask. Can you state it the way you wanted to state it?
Sure.
The last question you said?
Yeah, just what ask or what call to action would you have for people listening to the podcast?
So I think the call to action for me, it would be take some time and find your life purpose. Your purpose as to why you exist on this planet. And there's, you know, there are so many things that make people happy. But for me, living on this planet for the last 3 decades, and knowing a lot of friends and people, I've learned that there are 4 major things that make people happy. And the first one is being able to have sufficient funds to be able to sustain yourself, be able to pay your rent, pay food, be able to buy anything you want without stressing too much about it. The second thing is having relationships, you know, it's family, friends, spouses, children, people that care about you. And then the third thing is having good health. If you take care of yourself, you know, go for a jog, meditate, and try to, you know, stay healthy, because you only have one life and you can't abuse it too much. And the final thing that I think is very important that a lot of people don't spend time thinking about is the purpose. You know, you could get to the top, you know, could have all the money in the world. If you don't have friends, if you don't have, you know, if you don't have friends, you don't have good health, and you don't have any purpose, but you have all the money in the bank, you won't be happy. And there are so many people who end up taking the next job that's available because, you know, they just want to make money and they like the comfort and all the benefits that come with it. But money is not everything. Job is not everything. What's everything is being able to find time and locate your time among these 4 things, and you will be happy. Mm-hmm. So spend some time kind of finding your life purpose, and you never really have to work because you're working for something larger than yourself.
That's great. Well, Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the podcast with us today.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we provide Social Entrepreneur every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review Social Entrepreneur on iTunes. If you'd like the show notes, go to tonyloyd.com/040. That's TONY. LOYD with one L, tonyloyd.com/040. When you're there, you can find our latest ebook, which is 5 Key Traits of Successful Social Entrepreneurs. If you're not near your laptop right now and you'd like to have the 5 Key Traits of Successful Social Entrepreneurs, you can simply text the word SOCENT to the number 44222. That's SOCENT to the number 44222. Thanks for joining us again on Social Entrepreneur. And until next time, remember, use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. Talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.